people would shun it. A beverage bar and liquor store seems deserted and long ago looted. Colorado noxious weeds have taken over the parking lot, giving us the perfect setting in a low-life natural landscape. I'm shown into my new trailer, which I'll be sharing with Pimpleface, a nice enough guy who obviously doesn't let his oozing zits, boils, and abscesses bother him. He seems to be in a great mood as he describes how he quit school and devoted his life to eating potato chips. I also meet Boarhead the Clown, but it's hard to have a real conversation with him because he's had that trepanation operation where a hole is drilled in your head and you are then high forever and can never come down. He talks complete nonsense, but everybody here pretends to understand. Polka Dotty checks in on me and confides she already made out with Buster, and that motherfucker can kiss. I'm so happy she's graduated to a man who wants to be touched. Maybe my good influence has been a help in the next chapter of her neurotic happiness. I curl up in an out-of-commission old tilt-a-whirl car seat that someone has thoughtfully made up for me as a bed inside a trailer and slowly drift off. I wake up the next morning to the sound of hammering, buzz saws, and generator noise, and peek out. Good Lord, the hipster carnival is almost completely set up. I step outside in the sparkling clear day and see a small crowd of cool people who obviously know about the secret carnival and have followed online where it will open up next. I see Pimpleface unchaining the ramshackle front gate and letting customers inside. I'm amazed that he's not in the freak show he's just aroused about. I start to mosey through the crowd, but Polka Dotty rushes out, dressed in a sexy little magician's assistant outfit, and turns me right around and shoves me back in the trailer. Oh, no you don't, Mr. John Waters. You're a sideshow attraction now. Nobody gets to see you for free. Before I can even argue that nobody in Last Chance Colorado will know who I am, she whips out a white ski mask with a caricature of my face and my mustache drawn in black and pulls it down over my head. There you go. Nobody will think it's the real you. I look out through the eye holes and feel exactly the way Michael Jackson's son Blanket must have felt when he was young. I go on in 15 minutes. I'm so excited, she gushes, as she grabs my hand and starts dragging me through the oh-so-groovy crowd, many of whom seem to be getting high. Even as a screwed-up little girl, I wanted to be a human target, she confesses, as we pass the joints, different games of chance. I see the meat wheel, where you spin and, if you're lucky, win a pork butt or some veal cutlets. And the mystic coin toss. Happy customers are rewarded with vintage, no longer available cigarettes, unfiltered Cools, L&M's, even Montclair's. Charlene, this is John Waters, Polka Dotty introduces me to a blousy but tough-looking middle-aged white lady who only has one arm but seems to be able to serve the black cotton candy at her booth and make change easily with the added help of her mouth. She's in the sideshow, too, Polka Dotty proudly announces, before whispering so Charlene can hear. Look at her eyes. Nice to meet you, Charlene says, giggling, ignoring my mask, and offering me some of her goth-spun sugar treat. As I decline politely, I notice some movement in her eyelashes. Crabs, whispers Polka Dotty. I try not to let my pupils bulge in surprise, but Polka Dotty's right. Charlene has crab lice in her eyelashes and eyebrows. Every once in a while, she'll absentmindedly pick one of these little parasites off, examine it briefly, then crush it with her fingers. Also known as Lady Vermin, she announces, sticking out her hand to shake. Proud to be working with you. Puka World, reads the giant banner hanging over the midway rides. Come on, let's go on one, Polka Dotty begs with childish excitement as I see three dented drunk driver Dodgem cars giving sparks off the tin ceiling as they circulate around a pile of old rubber tires. Big cans of Colt 45 are being given out to the boisterous, already inebriated drivers in the line. 8, 4, 2, 7, they count backward incorrectly, while others purposely walk wobbly-legged in a supposed straight line. I've got the whirlies, yells a new ticket buyer as he jumps in the Dodgem car and promptly passes out at the wheel. I can't go on rides that go around in circles. I get sick, I beg off to Polka Dotty. But that's just the point. You're supposed to puke on these rides, she argues, pointing to an old, rusted roundup. The caged ride where you don't even get strapped in the spinning wheel as it raises its axis because the centrifugal force keeps you in. I look up and see an entire metalhead family puke at the exact same time and scream in delight when the vomit flies back into their faces. Buster tells me his rides are the best because they really are scary, Polka Dotty confides, impressed. Most are either defective or have had maintenance issues. Many have never been serviced because he gets them for free from third world countries. Isn't that fantabulous? Before I can answer, we're in front of the Caterpillar, a favorite ride in my youth that you never see anymore. Aw, sighs Polka Dotty in hard-boiled nostalgia as she watches with me, the continuous string of cars revolving and undulating in a wave-like circular track at a growing speed. At maximum velocity, a green canopy rises and encloses the riders with a caterpillar-like covering, hiding them from the nosy crowd. Watch, Polka Dotty waves with a look in her eyes I'm beginning to know means there's a shock about to happen. As the canopy retreats, we see that all the riders have begun to have sex undercover and with erotic lateral force. Some are masturbating, others are in threesomes. One couple even manages to do it doggy style without being thrown from the car. I'm having so much fun, I debate just staying here forever. I'll go in here, I shout, seeing the liberal horror house, one of those rides that takes place completely inside a bunch of connected trailers. Little cars go through on tracks, and various scary objects pop out to give the rider a fright. The best one in the country, I confide, is the haunted house located in Ocean City, Maryland. It's worth a visit to this town just to go in. I've also loved forever the 1962 Diane Arbus photograph called House of Horrors, Coney Island, which shows the inside of the ride with some of the lights turned on and the ominous track for the car visible. Can anything be as scary as these two things, I asked Polka Dotty with giddy excitement. We'll see, she says as we spot Chili Dog, a ride jockey whose specialty Polka Dotty has already heard used to be picking up wallets that fell out of riders' pockets when they went upside down on rides and then denying he had found any such things. But that was before he worked at the hipster carnival, and now he couldn't be more helpful as he buckles us in the vintage little car and sends us on our way, zipping off and banging through a door with a photo of Richard Nixon on it. Inside it is pitch black, and even Polka Dotty screams when a Barbara Bush skeleton drops down in front of us and shakes like a goblin. Jerking along around sharp corners, suddenly the car breaks down, and we hear a witch-like voice scream, "You're out of gas, just like the rest of the world." We pull away with a sudden jerk just before the car behind almost crashes into us. It's hot as hell in here, I think, before we see a globe of the world drop down and burst into flame to tell us in a leftist way that global warming is still an issue, even here, where everybody is high, drunk, and happy. As we ride around another corner and into the next section of the horror house, a naked man wearing an oversized strap-on penis is lit up. Without warning, a huge load of fake sperm is shot right at us with the words "safe sex" blinking on and off in scary Halloween-style letters. Suddenly, hipster interns jump out in disguise as minimum-wage uneducated workers and steal our wallets at gunpoint, emphasizing how many small circuses and carnivals are not unionized. As we screech out in our car and exit into the blinding daylight, trying to wipe away the fake semen that must have stained our outfits, we are relieved to see the frightening load was created in disappearing white ink. Chili Dog returns our wallets in newfound honesty, as Polka Dotty excitedly tells me Buster pays a good salary to his workers, not in filthy lucre, but with high-grade herb. Time for work, announces Polka Dotty, and I see the freak show tent in the distance and gulp. I am at ease playing myself, but appearing on stage as a performer without writing my own script is terrifying to me. But Polka Dotty, I beg as she drags me over to the back of the tent to enter. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Just take off your shirt and pants and show the audience you don't have tattoos. What? I cry. I'm not getting naked in front of a crowd. Why not? She poo-poos. The audience won't be criticizing your body. They will just be amazed to see you don't have tattoos in this day and age. You'll be a triumph. 5-minute warning, Buster whispers to me with professional stage management the instant we enter through the tent's back flap. I take off my disguise mask as Polka Dotty gives Buster the deepest soul kiss I have ever seen in my life, sucking his entire mouth into hers. Gasping for air, Buster returns the favor, twisting his long tongue around hers like a lasso and then deep-throating it down to her tonsils with expert sword-swallowing, gagless oscillation. On stage is Clementine, the girl with the world's largest feet. This boast seems to not be exaggeration. Bigger than Clarabelle, she brags to the crowd, who stare back in awe. She must wear a size 20. Her toes are longer than my hands. Her ankles the size of my waist. She wears a bracelet on her big toe. Huger than Mr. Natural, she roars. These hipsters get the R. Crumb reference and applaud wildly. Sexier than olive oil, she shouts, trimming her toenails with a pair of regular-sized scissors. Surprising even me, Clementine flops back in a chair and holds her enormous, monster-sized dogs in the air for the world to see. Even bigger than Shaquille O'Neal, she screams, and I seem to be the only one in the tent who doesn't get it. He's a famous basketball player, Polkadotti whispers in explanation. I'm sorry, I mumble. I don't follow sports. Buster, dressed dashingly in his black leather knife-wielding costume, goes on stage as Clementine grabs up the large-sized bills, some still stained with cocaine traces, that the crowd has thrown to her for tips. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Buster begins as I'm grabbed backstage by Hal and Clara, the freak show performers who have been on earlier, wowing the audience with their human pretzel contortion act that ends with both auto-fellatio and auto-cunnilingus. No, I protest, as Hal gently unbuttons my shirt, and then Clara, with the help of Polkadotti, yanks off my pants. I can't be naked. I'm in my mid-60s, I argue violently as they make me step out of my shoes and socks. All I have on is boxer shorts. You have to at least flash, Polkadotti argues. Just let them see your cock and ass are tattoo-free for 1 second. You look great, Hal says with encouragement. Fashion-free at last, Clara says, beaming with respect. All the way from Baltimore, Maryland, I hear Buster announce, making his first appearance with the Hipster Carnival, not as a film director, not as a smart-ass talk show host or an overexposed documentary talking head, but as the freak he really is. More shocking than Octopus Man, more horrifying than the world's biggest rat. Here he is, you won't believe it, John Waters, the man with no tattoos. Polkadotti whispers, break a leg, and shoves me on stage. I've gone on so many times that I almost start doing my stand-up routine, but I get a bigger reaction from this audience than I've ever received at a college. They gasp. They shriek. They look down at their over-inked limbs and recoil. They look back at my skin, not judging me physically, just filled with admiration at my nonconformist courage of never getting a tattoo. Filled with the excited liberation of nudity, I drop trow and reveal the truth. I really am tattoo-free. The house goes crazy. I am showered in money, poppers, joints, even blocks of gold hash. I pull my boxer shorts back up, and Buster rushes on stage and holds one of my arms in the air as if I were Rocky Balboa, and I forget I even am John Waters. I bow deeply, then run backstage and get dressed back up like myself to the congratulations and embraces of all my fellow freak show brothers and sisters. But now it's Polkadotti's big moment, and I want to be here for her, just the way she was for me. Buster, still on stage, pulls back a red silk curtain to reveal a large circular wooden board with leather restraints for arms and legs. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce my newest assistant, he announces proudly, and let's hope her career turns out better than the last girl's. Her name is Polkadotti, and I am her knife master. Polkadotti slinks on stage to cheers, dressed in a one-piece gold bathing suit, throws off her cape, and is courageously strapped to the wheel by Hal and Clara. Buster takes aim. I hold my breath along with the crowd, and he spin throws the sharp blade, which whacks in between Polkadotti's legs with precision. She moans in newfound pleasure. Without hesitation, Buster quickly throws two more knives, hitting perfectly under her arms, and then even quicker, three more that outline her head, just missing by fractions of an inch, producing the perfect soundtrack for the finale of this exciting, dangerous act. I am so happy for Polkadotti. She is such a star, and she has finally found a danger top who can make her feel even more glamorous than an exhibitionist bank robber could. Buster unleashes Polkadotti from the wheel, and together they take their well-deserved bows. Macaroni hugs me backstage with her skinny little arms, and I hug her back but accidentally crack two of her vertebrae. Don't worry, she whispers. That happens all the time. After many curtain calls, Buster calms the crowd down. I have one last surprise, he announces, and Polkadotti looks offstage at me and gives me a wink. John Waters will now take the place on the wheel for the most dangerous stunt of all. The spectators scream their approval as I stand there, paralyzed, not believing my ears. Polkadotti rushes to me, grabs my hand, and drags me back on stage. Do you trust me, John? Buster asks, and all the freaks in the hipster carnival wait for my answer with loving patience. Polkadotti gives me a lunatic grin of sisterhood as I melt, swallow hard, and then answer, I trust you, Buster. The relieved and loyal cries of acceptance from my new family of fucked-up Cirque du Soleil rejects give me a strange courage I've never had the nerve to imagine. Polkadotti herself, straps me on the wooden wheel, and Hal and Clara give me a spin, and I try to pretend I'm a ballet dancer, focusing on one spot so I won't get dizzy. Then the crowd shouts out new excitement, but I can't see why they are cheering. As I spin faster and faster, I concentrate on Buster's image each time I'm right side up. Holy mother of God, Buster's now got a large hatchet in each hand? Hatchet throwing? Is this the rapture or is it not? Suddenly I feel and hear the loudest whack right by the side of my head, and then in a split second another one to the left. I am momentarily deafened, but as the spinning wheel begins to slow down just a bit and my vision and hearing gradually return, I hear the audience cheering anew and then see Buster putting on a blindfold. Good God, did I want this much of an adventure? He throws the hatchet between my legs with such force that the wheel splits in two, but my strapped-on body holds it together. The crowd goes absolutely bananas. I feel like the chicken lady character in The Pit at the end of Freaks, but this time I've given the Todd Browning-directed movie classic a tribute happy ending it so well deserves. At last, I am one with show business. Good Ride number 9, Bernice. Last Chance Colorado may have been the first chance I've had to be naked in public, but the carnival must move on, and so must I. Before the whole troupe wakes up, I sneak a note inside Polkadotti and Buster's trailer, thanking them for introducing me to a new kind of living theater, the closest I've ever gotten to Artaud's Theater of Cruelty, only nice. You can never have too many careers, I've always said. And now I write them, if the book doesn't turn out or fruitcake underperforms, I'll be back to spin for my supper. The sun is coming up and there's no such thing as rush hour traffic in this part of the country, but yet again, the very first car that approaches pulls over. The problem is, how do I get in? The entire vehicle, a beat-up yellow 80s Chevy Citation, is completely filled with books, every kind imaginable. Hardcovers, trade paperbacks, but especially mass-market editions, some missing their cover. The passenger seat is piled so high, I can't even see who's behind the wheel. Slowly, like a jigsaw puzzle being assembled in reverse, I see a face as she throws the book in the back, under the seats, even in her lap. Sorry, the rather haggard-looking woman in her late 60s, with the weakest chin I've ever seen in my life, mutters, "I like to read." "I can see that," I answer good-naturedly, as I jump in, pick books off my seat, and then pile them back in my lap. "I like to read, too," I say, taking a gander at the eye-popping cover art of the vintage sex paperback Teen Girls Who Were Assaulted by Animals. "This one is amazing," I say, wondering what the editorial meeting of the publishers could have been like to greenlight this title. Here's a niche audience I hadn't imagined. "All books are amazing," she corrects me with a passion. "Are you a librarian?" I ask cheerfully, knowing after being the keynote speaker for several of their conferences how wild librarians can be. "Not officially," she answers with practiced bravery. "I was," she confines, "and then something happened, and I wasn't." "Oh, I'm John," I introduce myself, trying to change the subject away from her obviously painful past. "They call me Bernice," she answers without fanfare, "and I read your last book. I love the chapter Bookworm, but you're too literary correct for my taste." Before I can stick up for my published reading recommendations, she suddenly brakes for a car that swerves around some tire rubble on the highway, and a huge pile of cheap paperbacks stacked pack rat style in the back seat collapses on top of me. I pick off Saddle Shoe Sex Kitten, Some Like It Hard, and Freak Out on Sunset Strip with the amazingly politically incorrect subtitle Fags, Freaks, and the Famous Turn the Street into a Hippie Hell. "They're not for me," she explains, as she pulls off I-70 onto a rural road. "They're for my book club readers." Before I can protest that I can't go off the interstate, she tells me, "Don't worry, I'll take you back to the highway." We cut back into an even less traveled country road, turn the corner, and see a Tobacco Road-styled hut constructed entirely out of paperback books missing their front covers. The owner has shellacked the books to make them semi-weatherproof, but the elements have not been kind. The volumes, soaked through many times from rain, are swollen, tattered, and can't offer much in the way of protection. Publishers don't want cheap paperbacks returned when they don't sell, Bernice explains. The newsstand managers are supposed to rip off the covers and turn those in, and they get their refund. The retail outlets are expected to just throw away the books. But I rescue them from this biblioclasm and redistribute the volumes to alternative readers at the lowest end of the used book market. I know it's hard to imagine, but a very few dedicated collectors only want books with torn-off covers. It's these specialized readers I serve. I am not alone. Flea market vendors, paper recycling workers, relatives of deceased dirty book collectors, we are united in a mission to do what libraries cannot, bring the customer the lowest of the low in literature. Ah, there's Cash, she says, as a skinny, grubby, 40-ish-year-old white guy with a pot belly and a Prince Valiant haircut comes out of his self-styled reading room. I quickly realize by Cash she means her customer's name, not actual money. Her books are, of course, free. Cash is a very specific customer, she explains. His books must be softcore and pre-porn, with a missing cover done by a collectible artist. He then actually reads these smutty volumes, writes endless critiques of the writer's style, which he never allows anyone else to read, and then uses the red book as a building block for another room in his shantytown abode. "Hi, Bernice," shouts Cash in some sort of regional accent too obscure for me to identify. "Hello, sir," she says with a literary grin. "This is my friend John." Cash completely ignores me, so Bernice just goes into her routine. "I got some good ones for you today," she promises, as Cash's eyes light up and he licks his lips in anticipation. "Here you go," she teases. "She'll Get Hers by John Plunkett. With a missing cover by Rafael DeSoto," Cash yells back with postmodern literary enthusiasm. "I remember that one, Cash," Bernice reminisces like the specialist she is. "That was great pulp art, but it's gone now." "Who wants to go to an art gallery? I want to read," yells Cash, as he grabs the volume and hugs it to his chest in literary fetishism. "How about this one?" tempts Bernice, holding up a yellowing paperback with both the front and back binding ripped off. "Remember the pulp jacket with the sexy lady on the couch clutching the pillow like her lover?" she quizzes. "Restless by Greg Hamilton," Cash shouts back like he's on a quiz show, "with cover art by Paul Rader. And I'm glad the cover is gone. I read these books, Bernice. I don't look at them. I read every word until I understand perfectly what the author was saying, just to me, the last reader these volumes will ever have." Bernice hands him the damaged volume, and he grabs it with a scary gratitude. "See you next Thursday, Cash," Bernice promises. And with that, we're back in the car and off to the next outsider reader. "I'm no judge of what people read, as long as they read," exclaims Bernice once we're on the road. "Are all your books dirty ones?" I ask with great curatorial respect. "No," she answers proudly. "I've got true crime, too. A lot of libraries won't carry the really gruesome ones, just like bookstores. They discriminate, putting the true crime sections way in the back of the store, hidden near the gay section." Before I can agree, she gives me a sudden look of traumatic desperation that stops me in my tracks. "Believe me," she whispers sadly as we pull into the driveway of a suburban ranch house, "I know about censorship." Out comes Mrs. Adderley, a most unlikely matronly true crime reader, still dressed in her house coat. "Hi, Bernice. I'm glad you're here. I got in a fight down at the library just yesterday. They take my taxes. Why can't I have a say in what books the library buys?" "Hi, I'm John," I butt in. "I thought the library had to get you a book if you asked for it." "Oh, they say they do," Mrs. Adderley answers without missing a beat. "But they lie. I happen to be obsessed with womb raiders. Are you familiar with that genre?" she asked me point blank. "You mean women who tell their husbands they're pregnant when they're not and then follow real pregnant ones, kill them, cut out their babies, and take them home claiming they've just given birth?" I reply. "That's the ones," acknowledges Bernice, impressed I'm so well-informed in the specialized field. "Well, I read Lullaby and Goodnight by D.T. Hughes," Mrs. Adderley continues. "But there's another one I want, Hush Little Baby by Jim Carrier, where the raider cuts out the baby with the mother's car keys and the baby actually lives. Well, this literary snob of a librarian says to me when I ask if she has the book, 'There's no need to know about something that ugly.' 'Yes, there is,' I yell in outrage, completely agreeing with Mrs. Adderley's anger. 'The public needs to know,' I rant, 'that when you're pregnant, strangers are following your every step, ready to jump out and cut out your baby with your car keys. Womb raiders are everywhere.'" "Exactly," agrees Mrs. Adderley, thrilled to have someone else in her corner. Bernice gets a sly grin on her face and whips out a mint-condition bound galley of this very title and hands it over. "Oh, Bernice," Mrs. Adderley gushes, "you know how to make a true crime buff happy. Thank you from the bottom of my black little heart." We're off. I'm impressed. Bernice turns on the radio and we hear that delightful little country song, "Swingin' Down the Lane" by Jerry Wallace. and merrily sing along, harmonizing over the instrumental bridge between verses. I continue picking through the books on the floor by my feet and laugh at One Whole Town, H-O-L-E, a hilarious titled softcore vintage gay stroke book. "You want that one?" she asks with generosity. "Sure," I say, mentally adding this rare title to my collection of cheesy gay sex paperbacks. "It would go right along with my chicken volumes," I tell her. "You mean titles with the word chicken in them?" she asks, immediately understanding my oddball bibliophile specialty. "Yes, I've got Uncle's Little Chicken, Trickin' the Chicken, Chicken for the Hard Hat, even Chain Gang Chicken." "I know them well," she answers with bibliographical respect. "And you, Bernice," I gently pry, "what kind of terrible books do you collect?" She freezes, suddenly protective of her most private scholarly tastes, but then seems eager to have someone in whom she can confide. "The novelization of porn parody movies," she admits with great pride. "It's a small genre, but one that is growing in importance," she explains with deep knowledge of her field. "I tried to introduce these specialized volumes to the general public when I was head librarian in my hometown of Eagle, but Colorado is such a backward state. Trouble started as soon as I displayed Splendor in the Ass and Homo Alone with the covers out instead of spine in. Busybody little prudes noticed and made a big deal out of it, but I stood strong against censorship. Porn parody titles need to be discovered and celebrated. I was vilified in both the local and national press, but I didn't care. I fought back. I passed out valuable, extremely rare copies of Clitty Clitty Bang Bang to any high school reader in the library who asked for it. Satire needs to be taught. These youngsters love Clitty, but I was fired. I called the Kids' Right to Read and the National Coalition Against Censorship organizations, but they wouldn't help me. I became a scapegoat for the humor impaired. Before I can offer my unbridled support, she pulls her car over to the I-70 West entrance ramp, and we are buried in sliding paperback books. With great concern and kindness, she asks gently, "Do you have the 12 inches series?" "Yes," I murmur in excitement, trying to stack Bernice's volumes back up in some kind of order. "I've got 12 inches, 12 inches with a vengeance, 12 inches around the world." "But do you have 12 inches in peril?" she demands with excitement, whipping the title out from inside her glove compartment and holding it up like the Holy Grail. "No," I shout with rabid delight, quivering in reverse literary excitement. We look at each other in our love of disreputable books, and she hands it over, completing my collection. "Thank you, Bernice," I say in heartfelt appreciation, caressing this title like a sexual partner. "You must go now, John," she says with sudden concern. "I can't be exposed. My readers will continue to hide me. They know. They know I'm the best damn alternative librarian in the country." "You should be proud, Bernice," I say as I get out, bow in respect and blow her a kiss goodbye. "Run," she says with urgency, "run to read." But where do you run to in Parachute, Colorado? Good Ride Number 10, Gumdrop. Up the hill, that's where. And lo and behold, here comes a truck. Please, dear God, let him stop. Even though I don't really believe in God, or at least any of the ones I've heard about, my prayers are answered. I run up to the idling Kenworth 18-wheeler, lugging my bag, and climb up into the cab. Behind the wheel is Gumdrop, a cross-country driver for Farley's and Sather's, a large candy company. He started his route in the Midwest, and he's on his way to a candy wholesaler in L.A., a little too far south from my journey, but a good ride to Utah, where I'll jump out and head north to Reno and then down on into San Francisco. Imagine my delight when Gumdrop starts talking about candy, Mexican hats, red hot dollars, dots. He likes the same treats as I do. He's cute, too, but I don't get any sexual vibes. He's just sweet, like Swedish fish. "How about juji fruits?" he asks with a wink and a smile, showing a chipped but beauteous front tooth. "You're kidding," I answer. "That's my favorite candy of all." "Filling rippers," he yells enthusiastically, agreeing with my candy connoisseur opinion. "My dentist warns me off juji fruits, but I say fuck him," I brag. "I love those chewy little pellets." "But not jujubes, right?" he answers with sudden concern. "No, they're too hard," I answer. "That's because they use potato starch instead of cornstarch as their primary thickener," he explains. "And jujubes are cured longer, making them tough. Hard as nails. Inedible, if you ask me." "I agree," I answer in breathless candy brotherhood. "Nothing resists a bite more perfectly than a fresh juji fruit." "Guess what?" Gumdrop says, leering. "I've got a whole truckload full of them." Kuji Fruits, I ask, in a sugar frenzy? Yes, sirree, he boasts. They make them in Creston, Iowa, and that's where I'm coming from. You should see the plant. Huge tubs of Kuji Fruits. Thousands and thousands of those sweet little nuggets popping out of the sugar machines every minute. They don't make the small boxes anymore, damn them. But I've got 20,000 movie theater-sized boxes in the back of this truck. And, he pauses with drama, can you keep a secret? Sure, I pant, just imagining the orgy of flavor in the rear. I got mint ones, he whispers conspiratorially. The flavor those confectionery fascists discontinued in 1999. Good heavens, I moan. I haven't had a mint Kuji Fruit since then. I thought they were totally unavailable. They are, he answers with penny candy vigor, unless you're in the distinguished company of yours truly. I didn't get the name Gumdrop for being a candy dabbler. I've been saving them. Look, he whispers with pride as he pulls out a small trash bag filled with mint-flavored forbidden treats. Can I have one? I ask, shaking in candy awe. You sure can, John, he answers, and my mouth is watering so much I don't even realize he has recognized me. Here, he offers, picking a few mint-green Kuji Fruits from the bag. I nibble some out of his callous hands the way a horse would go for a lump of sugar, and he doesn't seem to mind. I savor the tangy flavor that may once have been the most unpopular shade, but what does the public know? I've been thinking outside the Kuji Fruit box for years, and I'm honored to report that this discredited, chewy little fella retains its original flavor with gusto. Look, I gotta be honest, Gumdrop announces as we finally turn back onto Route 70 West. I love Pink Flamingos, but I hated that hairspray shit. You hated my hairspray, I asked, nibbling our highly collectible treats on my own? The one with the vine and Ricky Lake? Yeah, he says with a shrug. I like crazy shit, man. Ever been to a pirate truck stop? He asks with a newfound friendliness. I don't think so, I respond, already intrigued. What are they? The illegal ones with strippers and gambling, he explains with obvious excitement, and free liquor. Sounds good to me, I cheer. I hate that Natso organization, he sees. All these goddamn safety rules, weight restrictions. I don't want no truck plaza. I want a fucking truck stop. No fence parking lot. No security cameras. Just some kick-ass trucker fun. Let's go, I scream, realizing we've been on the road for hours. It's getting dark and I'll need a place to sleep. I know a great one, and it's just outside Fillmore, Utah, he explains. It's not on any AAA map. It's an outlaw truck stop, all right. The Gas and Go-Go. Yay, I yell, probably too enthusiastically. I'll pay for the rooms. Now, John, he suddenly counsels, I gotta get one thing straight. I'm not a fag, nothing against them, but a hairy ass crack just don't do it for me. That's okay, I mumble, oddly touched by his total unawareness of politically correct gay speak. Not everybody is queer. It's no big deal. But I'll watch over you, he offers almost tenderly. I'll make sure nobody fucks with you. Deal? Deal, I say, as we pull into the scary-looking Gas and Go-Go truck stop parking lot. Lot lizards patrol the corridor between trucks, and I can see full-tilt female-male blowjobs going on right out in the open. Truckers are walking around openly guzzling from liquor bottles and laughing and slapping each other on the back in off-work revelry. I get out of the truck, and I see Gumdrop swallow, without water, two pills that look like black beauties. God, do they still make them, I ask? Want one? Gumdrop offers kindly, but I decline, trying to imagine flying on speed at my age. Gumdrop high-fives a few other drivers he obviously knows and leads me towards the truck stop's party palace, which has all the windows blacked out and just one small light bulb illuminating the entrance. Frightening hookers approach, but Gumdrop barks, "No, Arl!" and they back off in respect. Don't worry, they got fags here too, Gumdrop tries to comfort me. But I'm not concerned, I'm having a great time already. I'm introduced to a big hog of a bouncer named Joe Eddie. I love the rosary job in Multiple Maniacs, he says gruffly, as he rubber stamps my hand with a gear stick penis logo. Thank you, I answer, as he hands me two free speed VIP tickets. Fuck your brains out, he welcomes Gumdrop, who just chuckles and asks, is Fumbelina working tonight? She sure is, Joe Eddie responds lecherously. I love that bitch, Gumdrop explains, as we enter the dark, hot truck stop nightclub that has been off the beaten path for so long that it is now completely claimed by law-breaking truckers lucky enough to know this place still exists. Everybody inside seems to be high on crank, big time. They're drinking, too, and truckers clap wildly as the strippers slide up and down poles made out of truck tailpipes. One girl slaps her ass with an oil stick as she dances to Hot Wheels, an amazing Johnny Cash sound-alike tune with the lyrics, "I'm taking little white pills to keep me awake and pushing on down the line." I love this song. When I hear the trucker horn sound effects mixed in with the chorus, I know I'm in the right place. Maybe I can use this song in my next movie soundtrack. Gumdrop leads me to a bar and orders me a free vodka without even asking what I drink. He just knows. He gets gin for himself and guzzles it down in one gulp and burps out the sound of a busted truck muffler with amazing realism. He drags me through the partying drivers, many of whom are dancing recklessly with other scary women. I see a red-hot dancer who looks like a gal in a Russ Meyer movie, undulating with precision in a bikini top and a micro miniskirt. Gumdrop races ahead and stuffs a $20 bill down her cleavage. On cue, she retrieves the bill from between her giant tits, pretends to drop it, spreads her legs in a practiced stance, and bends over to pick it up. She is, of course, wearing no underpants. Knowing the routine, Gumdrop leans his head over between her legs and looks up to Cupid's cave. Fumbelina purrs, smile, you're on candid camera, and takes a picture with the expert muscle control that can only come from years of training. I have never seen a man look happier than Gumdrop does at this moment. He fumbles for another double sawbuck, and in between her knockers it goes. Once again, she pretends to be all thumbs as she retrieves it and drops the 20, and slowly, very slowly, bends over to pick it up. Take two, Fumbelina chuckles as Gumdrop takes his place below and says, say cheese, through a shit-eating grin. Again, she snaps his photo with vaginal precision. I can see Gumdrop's eyes beaming in gratitude. Fumbelina, this is John Waters, he says politely, poking me in the side to let me know I, too, should give her a 20. Nice to meet you, she says as I slide a bill inside her super vixen breast, and Gumdrop slaps me on the back in approval. Fumbelina fumbles the bill, drops it in choreographed clumsiness, bends over to pick it up. I hesitate, knowing what is expected of me. Don't worry, I'll retouch the picture, she says with a giggle, and I take my place between her legs, looking up into her natural lens. Hold still for focus, she orders, and I do. Click. Yikes, a snapshot. I feel like Lee Miller as she modeled for Man Ray's first solarized photography, the rayograph. See over there, asks Gumdrop, pointing to a curtain in the back. Yeah, I say, noticing a few truckers sneaking behind it every once in a while. Take a look, John. You'll be okay. I'm going to let you explore a little on your own. There's a bunch of you cocksuckers back there, he explains in the nicest, most unjudgmental voice imaginable. I laugh out loud at his clueless homophobic words that belie his gay-friendly attitude. He just doesn't know. I'm not offended. Actually, it's kind of sweet. I realize Gumdrop would like a little more quality time with Fumbelina, so I decide to be brave. Okay, I reply, still sounding a little worried. I got your back, he says assuredly. I look around at all the tough guys ear-banging each other in amphetamine delirium, laughing at nothing and celebrating the very act of not thinking, and feel safe here in this paradise of trucker sexuality. Who needs intellectuals when you're having fun? I head toward the mysterious curtain, hesitate, pull it back, and go inside the hidden annex. It's little, but oh brother, I'm in fag heaven, as Gumdrop might innocently say. Queerbait go-go boys are everywhere, and the truckers in this audience are just as wild and hopped up on speed and hooch as their straight brothers out front. Every time a new dancer is announced, they shout, whip it out, or get it, just like characters in my old films might. Basket seems to be a real favorite. He's got a huge tattooed cock that he stirs drinks with when he kneels down on the bar. And then there's Chicken Little, who's just my type, a baby-face ruffian who, much to my initial astonishment, cold shakes Viagra on stage and then shoots up, just as Gerard Malanga did with heroin in 1966 as the Velvet Underground played in Andy Warhol's Exploding Plastic Inevitable. Some of the truckers are jerking off in the friendliest way possible. Chicken Little's dick gets harder on the Viagra, and he circulates the room slapping customers in the face with it as they roll up bills tightly and insert them up his ass. Wow, this is my kind of club. But since I've already had two peculiar sexual encounters today, I decline Chicken Little's face-slapping, whap-whap-whap, helicoptering offer when he gets to me. I'm started to feel Gumdrop's arm around my shoulder. Shoot your shot, he asks, unembarrassed and possibly totally unaware that this was the name of one of Divine's early techno record hits. No, but that's okay, I respond in our newfound kinship of roadside honesty. I did, says Gumdrop with a twinkle in his eyes, before adding with a knowing laugh, come on, my diet pill is wearing off. Hey, that's a line from Hairspray, I respond. I thought you didn't like that movie. Well, he chuckles, leading me to the exit. I like that line. We head back toward his truck, and I ask if there are rooms we could rent so we could get a good night's sleep. "Nah," he says, "you don't want to get in any bed in this place. Besides, I'm going to take another upper." "But I've got to get some shut-eye," I beg. "I have to catch a new ride tomorrow." "I told you I'd watch over you, John," he says with unaffected kindness as he pops two more pep pills and swallows them down dry-mouthed. "You get your 40 winks," he motions to the cab of his truck as he climbs in. "I'll just watch." "Watch what?" I ask, confused but flattered at his nocturnal offer. "I'll just watch you sleep all night and make sure nobody harms you," he says tenderly. "Will you let me do that, John?" "Yes," I answer, completely touched by his unsexual kindness. "I certainly will." Good ride number 11, Space Cadet. When I awake after one of the most peaceful nights' sleep in my life, Gumdrop is in the exact same position, sitting in the chair, watching over me in bed. He looks a little tired, but still wired, and he could use a shave. Otherwise, he's still my nocturnal protector. I get up quickly and gather my few things. I know Gumdrop's got a shitload of juji fruits to deliver, and he has to head south. No way I'll risk hitchhiking on I-70 through Utah, where there's not even a rest area for hundreds of miles. It's time for us to part. He gives me a lift to a local porn wholesale outlet warehouse and drops me off, assuring me this is a destination location that many interstate truckers visit. I know I'll never see Gumdrop again, but we do have our juji fruit memories, and that's all I can ask for traveling these lonely highways. You only get a real fairy godfather for a few hours in life, I'm afraid. He's off and I'm all by myself, the way everybody really is no matter where you are. There's not a car in sight on the road, so I just stand there, feeling the power of being alone and hopeful. I see a desert rat-type guy in his late 40s coming out of the porno outlet, empty-handed. Who would come all this way to an X-rated warehouse and not find a thing? This big guy, who looks part cowboy, part mental case, gets in a broken-down early 80s AMC Eagle and peels out towards me. Will my amazing luck continue? Of course it does. He stops, and I get in. Up close, he looks like a real space cadet. I introduce myself, and no internal debate here. My rider has no idea of who I am. I tell him where I'm going. "Headed that way," he mutters, "right to the middle of nowhere." I'm not sure if seeing him come out of a porn outlet is a thing I should quiz him about, but I do. "You like adult movies?" I ask, with as much nonchalance as I can muster. "Never look at that shit," he says without rancor. "I just sell my old tapes when I need the money." "Your tapes?" I ask with newfound interest. "Yeah, I used to do that shit for a few years, way back, before I had my encounter." What kind of films?" I gently pry. "Gay porn," he answers unembarrassed. "I ain't queer, but I could get my dick hard no matter who was sucking it," he chuckles with nostalgia. "What was your porn name?" I ask, trying to look into his ravaged face to remember a possible stud from yesteryear's smut. "John," he says shyly, and then it hits me like a ton of bricks. "Johnny Davenport," I shriek. She scolds, suddenly paranoid. "They'll hear you." "Who will hear us?" I ask, confused, as I look out to the empty landscape surrounding us. "Them people," he answers vaguely, before correcting himself. "Well, not people exactly, but just them." "God, you were my favorite porn star," I gush with shocked enthusiasm, remembering the weird sexiness this muscular Eddie Haskell look-alike stud muffin with the curly hair and the humongous dick brought to the screen. "That was all bullshit," he mumbles, dismissing my praise without an ounce of vanity. "I especially loved you in Power Tool," I continue, not being able to control myself when you did that great jailhouse face-fuck scene with Jeff Stryker watching, jerking off from another cell. "Yes, Jeff was all right," Johnny admits, with only a slight tinge of nostalgia for the bad old days. "I know Jeff Stryker," I tell him. "I saw his show, Jeff Stryker Does Hard Time in New York. He was so amazing, especially after the final curtain. As the ticket buyers left the theater, Jeff stood at the exit wearing an open bathrobe showing his fully erect penis, and each theatergoer could pose for a photograph with Jeff and his dick." Johnny doesn't look impressed. "I have his contact information. Want it?" I excitedly offer, imagining the prospect of these two retired sex machines hooking up again. "No," he spits out with sudden anger. "I don't care about those fuckers, and I told you to keep your voice down. There's things you don't know. They're listening," he whispers with an insane urgency. But I'm too worked up to stop. "John E. Davenport," I say again, pinching myself that I'm actually in the car with him. "You were so good in The Young and the Hung Part 2. I loved you in Full Grown, Full Blown, too. You think I know what those pieces of shit were called? He asked with contempt. I just needed cash. But you won the 1987 X-Rated Critics Award for Newcomer of the Year, I argue, trying to give him a little self-worth and letting him know he still has fans out there and they've been searching for him for years. Yeah, he grumbles. I've heard all those lies, that I'm a mountain man living in Albuquerque with a wife and kids. It's all hogwash. Now shut up about that crap. Suddenly I'm silent. I look at my watch, but it stopped. Johnny gets a strange look in his eyes and a tiny grin appears on his weather-beaten lips. This guy has been in the sun too much in his later life. He's still strangely handsome, but scaly, almost like a Butch Gila monster who's obviously got a screw loose. They heard you, he announces with clarity, then slowly pulls the car over to the side of the road. It is eerily quiet, but suddenly the radio comes on all by itself. Flying Saucer Rock and Roll by the all-time coolest rockabilly singer Billy Lee Riley blares out. But Johnny barely reacts and certainly doesn't see the humor in this novelty song. Oddly, he begins singing along with the Little Green Men. They were really hep-cap lyrics with complete seriousness. My eardrums start popping as if I were on an airplane, and I feel the car begin to vibrate even though we're not moving. Ever fuck a spaceman? Johnny asks with a sudden horny gaze. It's the last thing I remember. Suddenly, we're on board a spaceship that is so cheesily decorated it could be a set from that Zsa Zsa Gabor movie Queen of Outer Space. There are aliens, too. Stupid-looking ones. Nude. Green, of course. Supporting soft bodies. Margaret Keane eyes, but weirder. Almost like the cunt eyes Crackers rants about in Pink Flamingos. A line that I still can't believe I actually wrote. They've got no hair, although a few of them seem to be wearing bad wigs, and have fingernails that curl around like claws. They've got big dicks, too, but no balls. I'm afraid to look and see if they have assholes. There doesn't seem to be a female in sight. Suddenly, Johnny seems relaxed. At home. Even when they all whip out from some 50 sci-fi microwave-type appliance what appears to be liver dinners and start eating with disgusting table manners. Okay, Johnny warns me. They're getting ready. Ready for what? I ask with sudden nervousness. For sex, Johnny announces with full acceptance. What do you mean, sex? I show with growing apprehension. Look, I'm no bottom in real life, Johnny explains, but with these little fellows. He lowers his pants and turns his butt to the space creatures. It's magic, he says to me in an almost spiritual way. A horny little alien heads towards me and starts making weird little frog-like croaks. Good God, I think I'm too old to get fucked. Is this safe? I yell to Johnny in a panic. Do they use rubbers? But it's too late. Johnny is being slowly penetrated by one of these ghastly creatures, but he shows no pain. In fact, his face reflects a delighted contentment I've rarely seen in a man his age. I feel a claw-like tentacle unbuttoning my belt from behind, and a wave of body odor like I've never smelled before overwhelms my senses. I refuse to look into the face of space rape, so I close my eyes. The rubbery appendage turns me around and begins to unzip my zipper. What the hell, I think. You've never been fucked by an extraterrestrial. Go for it. But can you top from the bottom with a little green man? Please, no fingering, I beg. Remembering the Fu Manchu-type nails I saw earlier on these creatures, my limits are respected. But then something, some rod-like growth with a fiery magnetic field and a friendly elasticity, rubs up on me. I pass out. I awake in Johnny Davenport's car. I remember little. Good God, what time is it, I wonder, seeing the sun coming up and looking at my watch in confusion. It's the next day, I scream in horror, trying to recall the vanished hours. I feel confused, scared, but Johnny seems calm, content. Don't worry, he advises with experience. You'll feel it soon. Feel what soon? I shout in panic as vague memories of some kind of sexual rear entry stir in my mind. I'm not pregnant, am I? I cry out in paranoia, unsure of the scientific realities of post-alien sodomy. No, Johnny answers with patience, understanding my bewilderment. But doesn't your asshole feel different? Different, I consider? Not really allowing my anus to have mood swings? Well, no, I answer, embarrassed. But wait, I admit, as I feel a little tingling out back in my most private area. You have a magic asshole now, John. So do I, he announces gently, like some sort of holy man. Before I can scoff, I feel a pleasant turbulence in the area beneath my balls. The magic only lasts for 4 hours or so, but listen, Johnny farts eerily and poetically, and it's the exact opposite of a fart joke. A masculine aroma of courage and spice fill the air. I think of that porn movie with my favorite title of all, My Ass is Haunted, and wonder if the director also was backdoor probed by a spaceman. Use the anal magic wisely, Johnny explains, like some sort of Glinda, the Good Witch of the North. Wisely, I repeat, not sure how to interpret the specialized advice. Watch, says Johnny, as he lifts his legs and points one of his still round and sexy ass cheeks toward my forehead. Suddenly, I feel hair grow. I grab the rearview mirror and look in amazement at my receding hairline filling in with follicles. It works, Johnny boasts, as he spins around in his seat and gets in a semi-crawl position with his concealed magic anus aimed at the top of my head. My gray hair turns chestnut brown. See, he boasts as I notice a subtle vibration in the rear of his pants. Go ahead, try yours, he gently suggests. So I give in and concentrate. Slowly but steadily, my asshole propels me out of my seat with a supernatural power that allows me to hover in the air inside the car. Oh, God, I whisper to Johnny in a trembling but awed voice. What can I try it out on? There, my new guru says as he points to unidentifiable roadkill outside the car. The handle of the door pops open without my touching it, and I space glide out of the car and through the air with a miraculous grace and land right next to the carcass of this unfortunate animal. I hear majestic music that I soon realize is coming from my asshole and quickly learn I can control the volume through breathing. You got it, encourages Johnny, as he rises in the air of the front seat, propelled by his own magic asshole, which joins in with my symphony of unearthly anal tones so that our assholes build to a melodious crescendo. The roadkill's eyes pop open and the bloodied animal shouts, anarchy rules, just as the fox did in the funniest scene in Lars von Trier's Antichrist. Johnny smiles at me as the resurrected critter runs back into the desert. I get back in the car, and without discussing it, he pulls off, and we give our assholes a rest from their bewitched duties. I meditate on my newfound anal inner peace as Johnny drives away, staring straight ahead on the highway, knowing that he is only a bottom when alien abducted, still a real top in human life. He lets me out at exit 62 on 80 West, Lakeside, Utah, where he lives. I don't worry I won't be able to get a ride here in the middle of nowhere. I've got a magic asshole and a new head of hair. For 3 more hours, at least. Good ride number 12. A star. Such bliss, such power, such anal reinvention. And lo and behold, I see a limo approaching on the lonely highway. A beat-up one, but still, a real limo. I don't even wonder if it will pull over. My magic asshole is already twitching in excitement. Not only does the vehicle stop, inside is Connie Francis. You heard me. Connie Francis. I can't believe my eyes. I recognize her immediately, sitting in the back seat, wearing more makeup than Divine ever did, but without the joy. Spackle. Thick pancake makeup that seems to be put on with a trowel. She's had work, too. Permanently surprised, with those telltale puppet lines all plastic surgery victims have extending from the corner of the pulled mouth out across their cheeks. She looks sedated, almost as if you waved your hands across her eyes, she wouldn't blink. She's even, ever so even. I have been obsessed by Connie Francis's late career for years, and know she still occasionally performs, even doing 4.5-hour greatest hits concerts. God, if you can imagine the beauty and the horror of these shows, you will understand why I continue to be her devoted fan. Except for her chauffeur, who I soon realize is not a real driver but her manager, she's alone. A legend so oblivious to real life, she may not realize the music business has completely changed since she first became a star. A famous singer who sold more records than the Beatles, but has had to compete with her own horrific personal life. A one-time accordion-playing child star with demon father issues. A love affair with Bobby Darin she never got over. 4 failed marriages. Being raped at a Howard Johnson's by a still unknown and uncaught assailant. Commitment to 17 hospitals for mental illness. Who's sorry now? I am, goddammit, for all the hell Connie Francis has had to endure. But she doesn't seem fazed today. No, she speaks in a monotone but answers